Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Policy and Legacy Finance Committee. Today is Wednesday, January 16th, 2019. Welcome to our first committee hearing of the year. Thank you. And I would also welcome our newest member, Senator Howe. We'll have to housebreak him, looks like, and bring him on in. So with that, we'll get started. We have a full agenda on a very important, interesting topic. Thank you. And I would remind you to introduce yourself for the tape, please, and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Mark Abrahamson. I'm the Director of Plant Protection Division at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, so I'm going to begin have an interagency panel update here. Just to quickly summarize the roles of the different agencies that will speak in this first portion, Department of Ag, our primary responsibility is regulating the movement of materials that could move emerald ash borer, so we have quarantines on wood movement. And then we're also responsible kind of along with that in detecting and reporting new areas of infestation. DNR, of course, forest health management utilization for both our rural and community forests, and then PCA with wood disposal options. So each of the three agencies will speak here about the responsibilities. And while we have each of our own concentrations, we have on this issue worked very closely and in cooperation throughout the process. So my portion will be a little bit on the biology of the emerald ash borer. I've got a few props that will come around here. I've got a couple of pieces of wood and then a few vials of insects, and I'll refer to them as we go along. So biology of emerald ash borer, this is a beetle. So during the summer is when the beetles might be present, the adult beetle. They'll come out of infested trees, they fly, the adults mate, and then the females will lay eggs on trees. And the larvae that hatch from those eggs are what causes all the problems. So they are what tunnels beneath the bark. And when you have just a few larvae or a few emerald ash borers in an area, it's not necessarily a big deal because a few beetles don't kill trees. They'll create tunnels in them. But particularly in one of those pieces of wood that's coming around, you can see the trees can heal over those with new flesh. If there are not a lot of beetles present, and the trees can be perfectly healthy. However, a few beetles turns into lots and lots of beetles, and that's then when tree death starts to occur. And so that's ultimately what the problem is. The number of insects overwhelm the trees, and it's that the feeding activity of the larvae beneath the bark that severs the tree's ability to move food and water throughout it. And the problem is this happens faster and faster as you go through time. So this is a kind of a hypothetical growth model showing emerald ash borer population growth in red. And so the point here is that this is something that starts slowly with just a few insects, is not detectable for some period of time, but then once it starts going, it builds very rapidly. And so you can get a lot of tree mortality represented in the blue line in a relatively short amount of time from the point at which someone noticed it until that mortality starts to occur. And the insect is very easily spread. So when a tree is killed by EAB or is cut down because of EAB, that doesn't kill the beetles. They exist within the material. Firewood has been a main vector for this insect. So you have a piece of wood with insects within it. They complete their development, emerge in a new place, and start the cycle all over again. So it keeps perpetuating itself. Here's where we are in terms of the country. So the red dots show all the places where emerald ash borer has been detected in new counties. Most of the eastern half of the country has had emerald ash borer found in some way, shape, or form. You can see the native range of ash species in North America shown in green. A lot of the eastern species range is covered by EAB. And one good thing we have going for us is that you can see in Minnesota, it's still a relatively small part of the state that's affected. And there actually has been a big difference in terms of Minnesota versus the country in general. So this graph shows rates of spread in Minnesota on the red line and the country in general on the green line. You can see we've been lagging behind everybody else in terms of how fast EAB is moving through the state. There's a few things that I can highlight as to why that may be occurring. Can't tell you exactly, but we've had the good fortune of being a little bit farther away from where emerald ash borer first came into the country in Michigan, so we've had some time to do outreach, and that's one of the biggest factors in not having EAB spread, is having people understand it moves in firewood, don't move firewood to new places. Another factor is that our communities have had a chance to take action when it's turned up in those communities. So Minneapolis and St. Paul are a great example, being the first places where EAB was found in Minnesota. And those cities jumped on it, and that probably made a really big difference in terms of how quickly EAB has built up in those cities and been able to move out of it. Big part of that is, of course, finding EAB in the first place. We do a lot of work with communities on detecting it and then starting a plan. And then finally, we get a little bit of help from winter. So winter in Minnesota is not going to solve the problem for us, but it does help a little bit in terms of slowing down the spread. A really cold winter like we had last time, 2013-2014, the polar vortex, we measured about 70% mortality of EAB larvae in the Twin Cities during that winter, where we hit into the minus 20s. And 70% mortality puts a big dent in their population. It takes a while to recover. So that's probably also been a factor in slower growth in Minnesota. But it doesn't alleviate the problem. They still build to the point at which they're killing trees. It just might buy us a little extra time. So a little bit closer shot of where we are in Minnesota. This is where emerald ash borer is present. We've got 17 of 87 counties, about 20%, and only about 8% of our cities at this point where EAB has been found. So a couple of things. This is good in terms of much of the state is still yet to be impacted. Bad in that we've been dealing with this for 10 years. We have likely still decades in which to be dealing with in Minnesota. So it's not going away anytime soon. Much of the work to be done with emerald ash borer still remains in the future. One last point to bring up. There are some program changes likely at the national level. So USDA has proposed to deregulate emerald ash borer at the federal level. Right now, that's a cooperative program between states and the federal government. If USDA decides to discontinue that program, that doesn't necessarily mean that we have to do anything different at the state level. We can continue to regulate within the state. But it is a change that's likely potentially going to occur. USDA has put out that proposed rule change and has been evaluating comments they received on it. And that is where I'll end my remarks and turn it over to Forrest.
All right, good afternoon.
Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Forrest Bowe. I'm the Director of Forestry with Minnesota DNR. EAB affects all of us in many ways, from forest management to water to waste management and even to community health. And today's presentation, we hope to highlight the issues facing Minnesota's ash forests, as well as our community forests, our citizens, and update the committee on what we are doing. I want to talk about kind of two areas today, and with me I've got Mike Reinikainen. He's our state silviculturist coordinator. He'll kind of handle the ash forests, and when I think about ash forests, those are really our natural areas. They're managed forests and dominated by the ash species. But I'll start out with our community forests, and when I think about community forests, it's really those shade trees in communities and in neighborhoods, even on private land, that exists throughout Minnesota. So those two areas. So kind of setting the stage, statewide, we have nearly 1 billion ash trees here in Minnesota. And that means that about one out of five trees in a community is an ash tree. And those, of course, line our boulevards, our parking lots, dot our yards throughout Minnesota communities. And you can kind of refer to the graphic there, and maybe you can pick out your community, where you're at, and how much ash might be in that particular community. So just to kind of think about this a little bit, there's a couple of communities in the southwestern part of the state, Duran and Dumont, have over 60% of... Thank you. Over 60% of the trees in those communities are ash trees. And if you think about numbers, I might point it out this way. Brainerd has about 7,000 ash trees in the community of Brainerd. Duluth has over 51,000 ash trees. And Brooklyn Park has over 45,000 ash trees along its boulevards and in the yards. And so that's a big threat. And left untreated, ash trees will die. And the research has shown that 99% of them will die, even down to just a little one-inch tree. We would expect the level of impact from losing ash would be very significant and very similar to that of the loss of Dutch elm in the 1970s. Like ash today, elm was a large part of our community forest, but unlike ash, elm was only a minor component of our forested landscape, which in Minnesota, ash really dominates our natural forested landscapes. So that being said, communities are at the greatest risk and in the greatest immediate need of attention. Many communities don't know how many ash they have or where they are. They don't have a plan for how to manage them. They would be unsure on what to do, what needs to be done, and really have limited capacity to do any work around that ash. We've heard from communities that they need technical assistance to know what tools are available, how to use them, from treating trees to removing trees, planting new trees, and how to care for those trees once they are planted. And the ash management plans lay out a timeline and the resources needed to address EAB and their ash management. Ultimately, if communities don't have the needed financial and technical assistance, they'll have a community full of standing dead ash. And if communities are not able to manage their ash, that ash and that EAB then moves on to the next community and to the next community, and then ultimately to our forests, which will have broad environmental ramifications. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the costs, because I think you've got other testifiers that are even more experienced than we are. But as a reminder, there are 3 million ash trees in our communities around Minnesota. And so those costs for both treatment and removal can be significant. There are significant, like I said, there's significant financial and technical resources that are needed. We do have in DNR an urban and community forest program and a network of foresters across the state that are able to lend technical assistance to the municipalities and communities. But the financial assistance is what the communities are looking for. Last year, we had a one-time opportunity to get some grant money from the U.S. Forest Service, amounted to about $109,000. We offered that up to communities. We had over 100 applications for those limited $109,000, to the tune of $2.4 million of requests from communities across the state. So it is a huge need. And again, providing the resources to these communities has the potential to slow the spread to other communities and, of course, our northern ash forests. And then homeowners sometimes are unaware that moving the wood will transport those emerald ash borers to northern Minnesota, taking wood up to their cabins and unknowingly spreading EAB. So our work around not moving firewood and play clean go can and will make a difference. I had mentioned that Mike Ranikin will talk about our ash forest, so I think I'll turn it over to him right now. And we've got a lot of speakers behind us, and we want to keep moving. So, Mike, would you talk about our ash forest?
Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Mike Rainikainen, and I coordinate the silviculture program for Division of Forestry at DNR. That's all things that have to do with reforestation and tending of trees on state forest land, typically following timber harvest and sometimes before. I'd like to share the issues related to the ash forest with you, those natural areas and managed areas, the needs that we see, and then the goals we have as a division related to those ash forests. Minnesota is pretty unique when it comes to our ash forests compared to any other state that's dealt with this problem so far, and it's the size and composition of our forest. We can't compare it to anywhere else in the lower 48, and that means that there's some things we can learn from Michigan, Wisconsin, New England, but there's a lot of things we can't. We're kind of an uncharted water here. Statewide, there's nearly a billion ash trees, as was mentioned. Ash is the second most common tree genus in Minnesota. It dominates as the main tree species on more than 1 million acres. Minnesota DNR manages 170,000 of those acres. Recently, we have seen significant impacts in the southeastern Minnesota getting reports from our local cooperative forest managers that in some areas, all ash trees of any size are dead. Through aerial detection surveys, our forest health program has found damage on 5,600 acres, and they've estimated about 200,000 acres of forest stands are now infested with EAB in the southeastern part of the state. So the issue, the issues as we see it, kind of broken up by economic concerns and ecological concerns. Ash is ecologically the best suited species to be growing on this, these wet sites that it currently occupies. It's a million acres. Without ash using the water on those sites, the water table can rise to the point where you have a change from a forested wetland to some other type of ecosystem that's not forested. The additional water not intercepted or evaporated or used by these trees is not going to remain on that land. It will move. As that water moves, it's going to impact other landowners. It's important to keep these sites forested. Currently, ash forests and swamps play an important ecological role. They also support a unique collection of plant and wildlife. You'll hear about that later. They are vital to retaining water within watersheds. And as we look to the future without ash, it's important that we are thoughtful about reforestation to ensure we get some other trees established on these sites when ash is gone so we can keep water tables under control and plant and wildlife communities intact. So reforestation is one of the major issues that we see in ash forests, particularly establishing and growing non-ash trees once EAB moves through. Timber harvest is a tool we'd like to use to create growing conditions that would favor establishing potential replacement species on these sites. From regional research, we know that a few of those species that can grow and survive on these wet sites are floodplain species, but we definitely need more information and trials to determine other reforestation techniques to establish non-ash on these sites. So timber harvest can be designed carefully in these ash forests, and that's important because ash need to evaporate and transpire water that's coming onto these sites to keep that water table in check. So you need to retain a certain amount of trees to keep that water table in check. One of the main constraints right now is around economics. Economics will make it difficult to use timber harvest of ash to favor other species due to low volume of wood per acre on the sites and low demand. There's a serious need to develop markets to utilize ash wood. Additionally, the wet nature of these ash forests require frozen ground conditions for timber harvest to take place. There are concerns that frozen soil conditions may occur more infrequently and with shorter duration as winter's warm. So shortening and sometimes closing the annual window we have to harvest timber on these sites. All of these factors together make it very challenging to manage ash forests sustainably. Nevertheless, DNR has a mission to sustain these forests, brace for EAB mortality, and renew damaged acres, thereby maintaining benefits. DNR Division of Forestry has guidelines in place for managing this resource. They were last updated in 2013 and currently under revision. So what are our goals on these lands? Our primary goal on ash forests is to keep these areas forested for the benefits I mentioned before, primarily maintaining hydrologic function and minimizing impacts to habitat and biodiversity. EAB is not currently established at a level in our forested areas where any management tools have been taken off the table. Our sustainable timber harvest targets have called for an increase in ash harvest. We see this as an opportunity to create conditions to grow non-ash species on these sites. It's also an opportunity to get ahead of this beetle and get some of this wood on the market before the market's flooded with dead and dying ash. So at the same time, we hope we can stimulate market interest and get ash on the market in advance of dying ash. So again, strengthened markets are needed to utilize ash wood so that we may use timber harvesting as a tool to create better growing environments for non-ash. And we need to build our knowledge base, particularly on reforestation techniques. Which species will survive on these sites? How do we grow them to replace ash? So in conclusion, we are managing the ash forest on state land for ecosystem health and benefits, as opposed to capturing economic value prior to imminent EAB mortality. Primarily, we want to keep these forests forested. And with that, our presentation is concluded, and we'll hand it off to PCA.
Good afternoon.
Thank you and welcome. Before we hand it off, are there any members have any questions? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. One is, what are the replacement species that would replicate the aspects of ash that are desirable that you just described? And I remember with Dutch elm at some point in the recent past, I believe, we started seeing elm being planted that was either hybridized or came from somewhere else that is Dutch elm resistant. So we might be seeing elm again in our communities. Is there any research being done like that, at least for ash in our urban areas?
Chair?
Yes.
Senator Dibble, we could get into that now. I know MFRC is going to be presenting their leading research on potential replacement species, so I think they'll touch on that in a little bit. But the question about finding some sort of hybridized ash, there's work, I think, going on with that. In other parts of the country, I'm not very familiar with it. I do know that we're still kind of waiting on a conservation-grade elm tree that's also hybridized that we can get back on the landscape. So that's a long process for that research to happen and then turn into seedlings.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Then we'll proceed. And thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Benke, and I'm Director of the Resource Management and Assistance Division at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I want to thank the other agencies for the opportunity to work together on this problem. We share a lot of the environmental concerns that are expressed today, but one of the things that our agency needs to deal with is how are we going to manage that wood from the diseased trees once they are affected. In Minnesota, we approach all waste issues with the waste management hierarchy. We want to reduce things where we can. We want to reuse, recycle. We want to compost things and recover energy if we can. And this can apply to the issue with the emerald ash borer as well. In the case of the ash borer, though, we also need to make sure that the wood is managed in a way that does not impact or accelerate the spread of the disease. And so we want to make sure that the technology that's chosen matches up with that as well. So we can stop the spread of the disease, you know, that would be great. But if we can't, we need to look at options to manage an increasing volume of infested wood. The next slide kind of looks at what are those options for managing the infested wood. A number of possible options exist for the wood, such as timber harvest that Mike hit on. That is one way that we could look at it in terms of actual use or reuse, getting it into the market as a material for our forest products. I think is a really important aspect. That way, we would be managing the wood in the cycles that we've done, you know, currently with other managed species. That wood would be destined for lumber, for pulpwood, for strand board, maybe even firewood. That might work in the forest stands, the bigger stands, but it might not be economical for the boulevard or the small stands that exist in the community forests. You know, large stands of timber on a golf course, perhaps, or public parks might look into harvesting, but my boulevard tree and the one next door probably won't be in the same economics for that. As was mentioned and will probably be touched on further, you know, expanding the use of ash in wood products is really something that we need to continue to look at. Generally speaking, markets and utilization can provide a cost-effective means for managing wood from the infested trees, and even before they're infested, but even the infested wood can be used for various products, including paper, flooring, furniture. The University of Minnesota has been working hard to find new opportunities to use the ash material, and we need to continue that. In some neighboring states, they've looked to the USDA to help look at some urban wood networks to try and make sure that we can establish markets for the wood. The other option would be mulching or composting, and that's where we think a majority of the infected wood will end up. The wood that doesn't find a purposeful use can probably end up in that. And if you think about that, that's our local existing facilities, the landscape facilities, the businesses related to that, our woodlots, the yard waste facilities, and so on. They can accept those, and currently they have to work within the rules of the quarantine. But we may need to look at ways to manage transportation if we need other additional facilities. And one of those options might be biomass, energy. You know, the Twin Cities area is fortunate to have a few outlets for biomass currently, the district energy in St. Paul and Coda Energy down in Shakopee used biomass for energy. You know, wood used here probably wouldn't be regulated as a waste. It's a fuel. But the wood yards would need to have the permits for storage, especially if they were going to be handling increased volumes of the material. You know, if we're thinking new biomass facilities to manage that, we need to keep in mind that Biomass energy is complex, both from siting and permitting, and that the facilities have a long development period for new facilities. Minnesota has recently seen some biomass facilities close. The long-term drop in fossil fuel prices has contributed to that, so it might make it difficult for wood-based energy to compete in the current market. The other option could be to manage the wood for recreational fires. You know, burning of ash wood would probably be considered the last resort in bulk. It might have a place in terms of managing it for fires and potentially for heating. But it's still, I think, one of those things that we would look at as an issue. Increased and uncontrolled burning of wood would have a lot of impacts air quality-wise. And the currently, you know, I think we look at it contributing already. And so Minnesota residents would need to, I think, really look at that carefully in terms of the impact on the communities for increased fuel use from firewood. And infested ash trees can continue to harbor the larvae, as we've heard, once the wood is cut. So the transportation, I think, is real critical to make sure that it's properly managed before it's transported. And we have currently 124 or so yard waste sites across the state, according to our data from 2017. They accept yard waste for the most part. They're not all permitted to accept tree or what would be the ash tree waste. So we would have to make sure that if there was going to be an increase there in terms of management, that they would have the proper sites, equipment, and so forth available. You know, a substantial portion don't accept brush at all, so it might be new, and they would have to make sure that they would have staff available to understand and accept the wood. Some are run by municipalities, and they only accept their residential waste, so business waste from the neighboring boulevards with businesses would have to make sure that those would be accepted as well. And we might need additional analysis on the current capacity so that the ones we have don't get overwhelmed, and what portion of that wood waste that they would realistically be able to handle from a community would be, I think, important to understand. You know, when you transport the infested wood from a quarantined county, you're supposed to chip it into a 1-inch or less size, and that might not be suitable for other uses. Where if we think about incorporating it into composting in terms of a bulking agent for compost, so we will have to look closer at the utilization of that. Some operators have received the training already, and they understand real well how to handle things. We'd have to make sure that the rest of those across the state understood it. The next slide, you know, really looks at what are we going to do in terms of transportation and storage of wood waste. You know, all the options available for management seem to require some need for transportation and then the storage of those materials, either until markets are available or until the product can be incorporated into the existing markets or facilities. So it's difficult to predict how much we're going to need in terms of you know, how fast the waste will come into the waste stream and how quickly we can get it turned over into product or into compost or other things. Those sites that are out there are limited in terms of you know, their size and equipment and permits that they have. I think the other thing we've learned from Dutch elm disease that when you get large wood yards developing, they are prone to infestation and rodents and other things. And as we've learned, anytime you pile anything up, it starts to attract other wastes, and you got to make sure that they're managed as well. So if there wasn't a secure market, those storage sites might turn into unpermitted compost yards or other things. And I think we got to make sure that any of that wood that's left there too long and begins to decay may lose its opportunity for compost or other products. So the transportation distances, I think, are real important. Also, in terms of how far can materials go to other facilities, if we chose biomass facilities or compost facilities, how far can things actually be transported? So with that, I think those are a lot of the issues that we've thought about, and I think we have to start developing a little closer some of those issues and start to get plans developed for the varying communities as things are impacting them. Thank you.
Thank you. And members, I think we'll hold our questions to the end. So if you gentlemen would stay, so in case someone has a question for one of you, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'm batting a little cleanup here again for the agencies. So as you can see from the presentation here this early afternoon, there are a lot of different players needed to make combating this insect a success, you know, from the counties to private woodland groups, to industry, to cities, and to researchers as well. And if we're going to combat this insect, it really needs to be through a united effort, everybody working together. It's been 10 years since EAB was first discovered in Minnesota. And based on other states and our own experience, we know a lot more about EAB now and how it intersects with our forests. And remember, both community forests and our other ash forests in the northern part of the state. We also know that EAB, when it really takes hold, will be more impactful given the size and spread of our ash forests, and that we have more ash in Minnesota than any other state in the country. So it will be a big deal. So we have a lot of work ahead of us. We need to act on some of the lessons we learned from Dutch elm, and we need to plant a more diverse species both in our communities and in our forests. And we also need to balance the concerns between our ash forests and communities. But I would want you to understand this. The immediate need is within our community forests. That's where things are happening now. Maybe at some time in the future, 3 to 5 to 10 years, we'll need to focus more on ash forests. But the short term is certainly in our communities. We've got some recommendations. We think we need to continue to slow the spread and ramp up our efforts. And by continuing to slow the spread, it really provides us more time to allow us to absorb the costs. You'll hear a lot today, I think, from other testifiers in the communities about the financial assistance that they need in their communities. And then certainly you heard from Dave about really needing to think about how we dispose of all of these, of all of this ash. So agencies have a clear role. You've heard that today, and we're ready to continue to work on that. One of the agencies that isn't up here is the EQB. They were also involved with our interagency team and got folks together even this summer in some areas. But it's going to take more than just the state agencies, and cities will need to determine the best course of action for them. So with that, I think we'd like to transition over to the Minnesota Forest Resources Council with Rob Slezak. Rob is going to talk and answer Senator Dibble's questions about which species do better. So I invite Rob up to the table.
Thank you. Maybe we can have the next four up, and so we can. We have a lot of folks. I think we have Gina Hugo and Karen Zumach and Jeff Haberman. Lots of information for us today. Dr. Slezak, I think we'll have you start, and if you could remember to state your name for the record. Thank you and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Robert Slezak. I'm Director of Applied Research and Monitoring at the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. And today I'm going to be talking to you extensively about the forested northern wetlands that we have, our ash wetlands that we have, and some of the impacts that we've evaluated over the last 10 years and potential mitigation strategies that we might be able to do to assess the EAB threat. For the Forest Resources Council, the EAB is a big issue. It's a statewide, huge forest health threat to the fundamental functioning of our forests. And under our charge of the Sustainable Forest Resources Act, it really ties into what the responsibilities of the council are, which is to provide recommendations, policy recommendations, and practices to make sure that we're sustaining our forest resources into the future. And so it really ties into the charge of the statute, but also really fits in with the way in which the council approaches this, its charge. And that is, it's all lands. We don't just deal with state lands. We don't just deal with federal lands or private lands. But we really take a statewide, comprehensive, holistic approach to dealing with these issues by looking across all lands. And so it really ties in very relevant to this issue of EAB. There's several programs related to how we go about doing this. And in particular, of course, one of the more important ones is the Applied Research and Monitoring Program. And that's because of the role that science plays in how we go about making our decisions, and in particular with relevance today, the science that we have developed over the last 10 years related to Emerald Ash Borer. Okay, so back in 2009, you know, I have this news release thrown up here. This is Department of Agriculture news release. It was kind of initiated this flurry of activity, right? We thought we'd have more time to deal with EAB before it showed up. And, of course, the bug had different ideas and came onto the scene in 2009. And so, again, a lot of activity got going. And one of the things that really got our research project going was some initiatives by the LCCMR actually making requests to a variety of different researchers to come up with some really innovative ways in which we could potentially mitigate the impact of EAB. And so we put together this team that I have listed here to evaluate some of the impacts that might occur with Emerald Ash Borer and really come up with ways to mitigate the impacts of the state's resources. I put up this team not just to acknowledge their contributions to the work I'm talking about today. It really is a team effort. But I also put it up to demonstrate to you the importance of the issue. This is a multidisciplinary team. It's multiple institutions, state, federal, and really speaks to the role and the importance of EAB and the threat that it faces with our forest resources in Minnesota. All right, so why black ash? Black ash is the one that I'm focused on today. We have other species of ash in the state. But black ash is really unique because of the way in which it occurs within our state. So it's very extensive. As it was mentioned earlier, it covers about 1 million acres of the lowland ash forest in our northern forested region of the state. And it's not just that it's extensive in terms of geographic extent. It's also really important or unique because it's heavily dominated by black ash. So a lot of our other forests, we have a mix of species where if one died, for example, then another one could take its place in terms of the way in which that forest functions. In the case of our black ash wetlands, that's not the case. It's because it's heavily dominated and almost entirely composed of black ash. So once those tree dies, we suspect that it's going to have a really slew of consequences in terms of ecosystem functions because we view it as a foundational species. So in other words, because there's just only a single species there present, it has an overriding influence in terms of some primary functions, in particular things related to hydrology, water dynamics, and the influence that has on other ecosystem functions. And so our overriding objective when we approached this was really to think about ways to design a research project to maintain these forested wetlands, which we view as really important, maintaining the forested wetlands in a forested condition. And really what we're trying to do is maintain that picture on the left, which is a nice intact forest, maintain that in some way and avoid going to the picture on the right, which is more of an open water, marsh-like, shrub-dominated condition, and which is a real concern based on the work I'm going to show you here in a moment, and a concern primarily because we don't want to have any net forest loss within the state. So some key questions is just figuring out what some of the impacts of Emerald Ash Borer will be, figuring out the forest can recover on their own, right, which is a big question. Can we just allow the EAB to do what it does and then kind of wait for a period of time and allow those forests to become forests once again? Or if not, can we potentially mitigate actively to do some management to make sure that we maintain those forested wetlands in a forested condition? So I'm going to talk to you now about an experiment that we've installed up in northern Minnesota. This is one of the efforts that our team has done evaluating the impact of EAB on ash in the state of Minnesota. This is on the Chippewa National Forest, which has been a great partner in some of our efforts related to evaluating EAB. And what we did on that forest was we established four different treatments or manipulations to evaluate what the effects of Emerald Ash Borer and other management actions would be. And so the first was that we girdled all the ash trees. This is essentially simulating what Emerald Ash Borer does, right? You know, EAB is not currently up in the Northwoods, and so we had to, in a way, mimic or simulate what it would do if it was there. The second treatment was a clear-cut treatment, which was one management action we typically don't recommend, but wanted to just evaluate what some of the responses would be if that was done. The third one was more of a classic mitigation treatment where we wanted to just remove a portion of the forest, allowing forested conditions to remain somewhat stable, but at the same time opening up small gaps so that other trees could become established and slowly convert stand composition to something other than ash. Madam Chair, for point of reference, I know you were out there taking the time to visit with us this past fall, right about where those roads intersect was where we parked the vehicles and had a chance to walk around and visit some of these treatments back in late October there. Okay, so I'm going to just go through some of the big impacts. And the number one, I mean, these are forested wetlands, right? So water is a big issue. And one of the primary things we've been looking at is how water dynamics have changed following these different experimental manipulations. And one thing I want to really highlight, there's two things, really. The first being that if you look at these two figures on the right, you can see pretty clearly that the clear-cut treatment and that girdling or simulated EAB treatment has higher water levels compared to the group and the control treatments. And really, this is just indicative of once you lose ash, you lose the transpiration stream associated with it, and so the water tables start to rise. Everything essentially becomes a lot wetter. A thing to note is that over the last 7 years, I have these two panels here for 2 years, but really we've seen no recovery. Even up till our last year, these patterns are consistent and really are starting to indicate to us that what we had feared in terms of the forest slowly converting to a wetter, more marsh-like conditions is starting to manifest and is indicated with these types of responses. The other main thing I want to point out is that if you look at that group selection or those small gaps that on these figures, which is the gray line, really there hasn't been a large change in terms of the water dynamics, and which is a good thing. We want to maintain that hydrology so that we can actually have favorable conditions for the establishment of other species. And so this is one of our potential mitigation strategies that we've been focusing a lot on with our work. I'm sorry, I'm going to go back really quickly. What does this change in water mean in terms of overall amount? Right, because that's a big thing. It's not just the stand in terms of what it does for vegetation, which we'll see in a second. But in terms of quantity, it's a large amount of water. It's about 10 billion gallons. For point of reference, it's roughly about 300,000. The water needs for 300,000 people, roughly the size of St. Paul on an annual basis. All right, so changes in hydrology, what does it mean for vegetation? Well, certainly we could look at lots of data, but sometimes pictures are, you know, worth a thousand words. And so I'm showing you here some pictures from both the clear-cut treatment and the girdling treatment, and really demonstrating just visually what some of the changes have been in response to those changes in hydrology, those higher water tables, wetter conditions. And in particular, if you look at that upper right-hand picture, that's from one of the clear cuts. You can see it's dominated heavily by grasses and sedges. Again, this is just really indicative of what we'd think to see if the forested wetlands were transitioning to more of an herbaceous, shrub-dominated system. And we can certainly show that with our data, but also within pictures can see it quite clearly as well. In the girdling treatment, similar type of response, starting to see more of the sedges and grasses move into the understory, but also a lot of more shrubby species, alder, mountain maple, so on. Again, very indicative of that shift to a more open water, marsh-like condition. Of course, tree regeneration is one of the big things we're focused on, right? If you go back to the main objective, we want to keep the forest, and so in order to do that, you have to have trees. And so one of the big things that we've been looking at is how much regeneration happens when you do these different experimental manipulations. And just a couple things I want to highlight here is, first, if you look at this table across the top, black ash is by and large the dominant species that's regenerating. It's not surprising. That was the dominant cover type before, and the conditions there favor establishment of that tree species. But it's really not favorable for long-term response to EAB. EAB will attack all trees 1 inch in diameter and larger. So if you look at the rest of them, there's really only a handful of tree species that are present that can potentially serve that role that black ash plays in terms of maintaining ecosystem function. Levels of regeneration overall are pretty low once you remove black ash, and in particular with that red circle that I have up on that table, if you look at that simulated EAB, the girdling treatment, it's pretty low. It's the lowest out of all of them, and again, it kind of points to this worst case scenario where we don't have sufficient tree seedlings present in order to really establish a forest following EAB. One of the other main things that we've been looking at is wildlife. It's incredibly important in terms of what these black ash provide for habitat. Alexis Grindy leads the work related to this. She's very eloquent when she describes some of the effects. I'm not nearly as eloquent as she, but I do know that one of the things that she always says is that these swamp ash wetlands are really wildlife hotspots. And it's largely because of, there's a lot of structural diversity within the stands. We have a lot of down woody debris, hummocks, hollows, the overstory in terms of ash, but also smaller trees as well. And so you just combine all of those factors, it really creates a slew of microhabitats that are really favorable to a wide range of wildlife species. In the top upper right-hand corner of the slide, you can see that figure that's just showing some of the larger mammals that are present. So you have everything from marten to fisher, all the way up to deer and everything in between that utilize these ash swamps. And, of course, a lot of amphibians and birds do as well. When we lose ash, whether it's through the simulated EAB treatment or through clear cutting, use goes down. They just generally avoid some of those areas. They're not favorable for their habitat needs. And so there's clearly some impacts, potential impacts associated with wildlife. One of the last things that I'll talk about now is, you know, we've really been focusing on mitigation. This is our ultimate end goal, is can we actively do something to mitigate the impact? And so one of the things we've been looking at is what species can we potentially plant artificially to establish a forest following the emergence and move of EAB through the stands. And so this list on the right, some of the species we've been looking at, some of them are very common to black ash stands now. Some of them are a little bit out of the norm. So we have DED-resistant American elm, as was inquired about earlier. We also have some tree species that are more from our southern climate zones. And really just kind of trying to think outside the box about exploring what species could be doing better and potentially create that forested condition that we're looking for. With that said, survival overall is pretty low when you plant stuff. It's a harsh environment. Black ash wetlands is a reason why they're dominated by black ash currently. And so we need to overcome that and really identify some of the species that potentially can do well. So I've kind of just identified a handful here. One of them is, as it was inquired previously, DED-resistant American elm seems to do very well within these stands. Also a handful of species, swamp white oak and hackberry, which are from more southern seed zones, are doing pretty well in terms of their survival and growth. And we're starting to refine ways in which we can improve survival and growth with different establishment techniques and getting that information into the hands of managers. All right, so just bringing it back to reality, we started off with there's 1 million acres of black ash. There is, as best as we know by our estimates, plus or minus maybe 20% or so. And it's really extensive. So if you look at this map, it's primarily located in the north central, northeastern part of the state. And it's widespread. It's going to impact the entire state. At the same time, we have limited markets, right? So we heard earlier about some things. Maybe we could use it for pulp. Maybe we could use it for wood products. Those are all nice ideas, but the reality is those markets are very limited. And so we have this issue where we have a lot of ash that needs to be treated if we're going to mitigate the impact, and we have very low demand for that ash. And so if we're going to some way address this, we need to be thinking innovative ways about going about doing it. And if we don't, it's going to be very challenging to try and treat and mitigate this impact across the majority of stands within the state. All of our findings to date have kind of shown that what we had been concerned about in terms of losing the ash forest to more of a marsh-like, shrub-like condition seems to be the case, at least within the sites that we're looking at so far. And really, there's going to be some pretty pronounced impacts in terms of water, wildlife, and habitat. At the same time, we do know that we can do mitigation. It's just a matter of figuring out how to go about doing it and prioritizing which stands that we should actually be doing it at. Because, again, we have 1 million acres. There's no way in which we're going to be able to address all of it. With that said, we really have some information needs in order to do that prioritization work, including building upon the work we've done about identifying replacement species that are most suitable and some of the establishment techniques that can increase survival and growth, and also figuring out what the long-term response of that simulated EAB treatment is. If you can picture, for Senator Root, who was on the tour, she can picture this very well, but there's a lot of dead trees. They're just kind of standing up in the woods, right? And so right now we're at a critical point where they're starting to fall down. And we haven't reached that point yet, but within the next 3 to 4 years, it's going to become quite pronounced. So we need to know what happens when that occurs, just so that we can start to plan and figure out what some of those impacts are going to be long term. And lastly, I'll just close out with this whole issue with this disconnect between the amount of ash that we have and reduced markets available to actually utilize it. There needs to be a proactive effort to address that. We need to be working collaboratively to develop policy, science, operational practices to go about figuring out a way to move the needle and start actually making progress on trying to treat ash stands in northern Minnesota. You know, Forrest Bowe mentioned 3 to 5 years, maybe, when it gets really widespread up in the Northwoods, but personally I'd like to be moving ahead of that curve so that we can be preemptive in thinking about how we're going about addressing that. And the council recently has been approached by a number of entities, both private and public, to think about how we can start coordinating, bringing stakeholders together to start coming up with a very cooperative, collaborative way in which we can do that. And we look forward to working with others, including the committee, and anyone else in terms of achieving that in the future.
Thank you. And also thank you for being so kind to take me along on our tour. It was a pretty amazing day that we spent in the woods, and any day in the woods is a good day. Senator Dibble, did you have your question answered about the replacement? Thank you. All right. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Gina Hugo. I'm a forester with the Sherburne Soil and Water Conservation District. I also serve on the board of directors for the Minnesota Forestry Association, which is Minnesota's oldest conservation organization, actually established 100 years before I was born in 1876 to promote stewardship on Minnesota's private forest lands. I'm active with the Minnesota Shade Tree Advisory Committee, which is Minnesota's tree board, and you'll be hearing more from the president later on. And I'm a member of the Minnesota Soil and Water Conservation District Forestry Association. All of that is significant because all three entities collectively represent the spectrum of Minnesota's forestry interests, from urban to small town to greater Minnesota rural forest land owners. It's been over the last couple years that all three of these groups have identified the threat of emerald ash borer to Minnesota as an urgent priority in need of state leadership and funding. So I'm very grateful for this opportunity to be before you today with all of these great people. And I especially want to thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Rood, for coming up to that tour with us, where you were able to see firsthand what Rob just spoke about. As a group of concerned stakeholders, it's our goal today to provide information to you on the broad range of impacts that emerald ash borer is going to have on Minnesota's cities and towns, tribal communities, forests, wetlands, and water quality. You've heard from the state agencies responsible for preparing for and responding to emerald ash borer. You heard from the research perspective, which really reinforces the importance of ash trees to Minnesota's natural resources. Next, you're going to hear from experts and folks on the ground who will share impacts already being experienced to community budgets and just the challenge of dealing with a huge number of ash trees and then addressing the loss of those trees in the aftermath. So thank you again for allowing us to be here today.
Thank you. Who would like to go next?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Karen Zumach. I am the Director of Community Forestry for a nonprofit called Tree Trust, and I am also the president of the 400-member Minnesota Shade Tree Advisory Committee, first started back in the 70s in response to Dutch elm disease. We're a committee composed of public and private sector tree care professionals, interested citizens, and nonprofit organizations tasked at educating and informing all Minnesotans about the benefits of a healthy community forest. Those are the trees that grow in our towns and cities across the state. As you've heard from those who have come before me, EAB is a big deal. It's considered the most destructive forest pest to ever hit North America, leaving a path of hundreds of millions of dead trees in its wake since first arriving to the United States in 2002. As Mark Abrahamson indicated in his presentation, it's been found in 35 states and 5 Canadian provinces. And usually I wouldn't mention Canada, but two of those are Ontario and Manitoba. Therefore, we are nearly surrounded by infested areas of EAB. We've heard a lot about the black ash component, which exists in our state unlike anywhere else in the nation, making up a large percentage of those 1 billion trees in our state. This forested land is an ecological and environmental treasure for our tribal communities, the quality of our lakes and rivers, as well as the wildlife that call this part of our state their home. The threat EAB poses to our quality of life is far-reaching, leaving few concerns across our state untouched by its impact. As Director Bo mentioned, communities are that forefront, and that's who I represent today. It's imperative that we manage EAB where it is, and we can only do that through active management. So for now, I'd like to take you for a moment to a single tree standing alongside of a street in a boulevard in front of someone's home. Chances are pretty good that tree is about 40 feet tall and about 18 inches in diameter, which is about the average size of an ash tree in our urban and community forest. That single tree is providing benefits to that homeowner, to the city, to the county, to the state by mitigating stormwater runoff, conserving energy, and increasing property values. It's doing all of that just standing there. It's one of those few pieces of infrastructure in a town or a city that actually increases in value over time. So in short, big trees provide big benefit, and it's worth managing this pest in a way that can keep as many of those trees around as we can as we transition away from emerald ash as part of our urban tree population. So to put these benefits into numbers, the U.S. Forest Service created a tree benefits calculator. So for each 18-inch ash tree, the benefits include nearly 2,000 gallons of stormwater being mitigated every year by that one tree, providing a benefit of about $52, an increase in property value of nearly $50 a year, and with the additional increase in energy conservation, air quality savings, and carbon sequestration, that one tree is providing $165 worth of benefits every year. So as Director Bo mentioned, there's nearly 3 million ash trees in our urban and community forests across the state. To do a quick calculation just on that stormwater benefit, we're talking about 6 billion gallons of stormwater there that are being mitigated by this ash component. With that loss of that stormwater mitigation, we'd be increasing the stress on systems that are already feeling the squeeze, and as of today, there's no real plan in place to address that loss. Towns and cities may be required to deal with this through regulatory framework of their MPCA municipal stormwater permits. As Director Bo mentioned, our cities and towns are the forefront, and MNSTAC has been proposing a multi-pronged approach to assist with this battle for several years now. Mostly providing assistance in the form of matching grants to cities and towns to access all the tools that are available in the toolbox in managing EAB. This includes, as Director Bo mentioned, that inventory and management plan development, removal of those low-quality ash trees, treatment using a non-neonicotinoid insecticide that can help reduce that actual beetle population and increase the lifespan of those trees, allowing for that orderly transition away from this over-reliance on ash. And, of course, replanting trees, replanting those trees with a variety of species to create a more resilient forest. Research has shown that it takes 2 generations to restore the canopy after an invasive species outbreak like emerald ash borer. Also, we support the continued support of the research being done by the MFRC, by the DNR, by the University of Minnesota, as well as within tribal communities across our state. No one has ever tried to manage the pest like this in a place like ours. We need to keep the science moving, and we have smart, intelligent, impassioned people here working hard to find the answers. So one thing is clear, the time is now. We need to manage this pest where it is so we can allow for the amazing science to continue. It's come a long way since 2002, and we can manage this pest better. We have to. We have so much more at stake here than anywhere else, and we have to manage this pest before it ends up managing us. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sumac. Mr. Hoffman?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. And thank you for allowing me to share Rochester's story with you. My name's Jeff Hoberman, and I'm the city forester in Rochester. And we've been dealing with EAB since 2015 was the first year that we confirmed it. We've since created a EAB management plan. That plan includes components of both treating trees and also utilizing best management practices to slow the spread. And of course, we're removing a lot of trees. And so I'm going to share with you information on how this has impacted the city. I'd like to reiterate what others have said, that that management options diminish as tree mortality increases, and that EAB death curve, you roughly have 10 or 12 years to deal with this issue from the time you first find it till virtually all trees that aren't being treated are dead. And so that puts a big demand on departments like mine. Currently in Rochester, we have about 25.5% canopy cover citywide. This includes both public and private trees. And of that, ash comprises about 15% of that. Now, if you were to take that incomplete component out of our urban forest, that would decrease our canopy cover to 21.6%. That's a pretty large jump and something that, quite frankly, scares me. So I'm going to share some numbers. Forgive me. I'll try to, not bore you to death. And I do have, I did bring copies if anyone's interested in having this information. But I'm going to start with how tree mortality has increased since 2015, in which we preemptively removed 54 trees. That was largely utilizing grant money that we received from the DNR at that time. In 2016, we removed 428 trees. In 2017, we removed 1,045 trees, and in 2018, we removed 1,800 trees. So you can see how that tree mortality is dramatically increasing in a very short period of time, 3 years really. That's correlated to increased staff time to deal with it. And so our staff hours have increased in due to EAB management, or hours that we've dedicated to EAB management. In 2015, we had 849 staff hours. That was largely in inspections citywide to find out where it was at. In 2016, it went up a little bit, 964 hours of staff time, because we really weren't experiencing that increase in tree mortality and infested trees. In 2017, it took quite a jump, up to 2,917 hours. And last year, we spent 3,048 hours of staff time on EAB. So that number continues to increase, correlating to the spread of EAB throughout our city. Now, in terms of city expenditures and how it's impacted our budgets, I'll just use the same time frame. In 2015, we spent roughly $24,000 on EAB. In 2016, we spent $64,000 on EAB. In 2017, it was $172,000, and this past year, $266,000. So all told, to date, we've spent over $500,000 on EAB management. Now, I mentioned our management plan, which put an estimate to what this is going to cost our city over a 20-year time frame, and that cost was $5.5 million just to our city alone. And when you compare our city to some of the others that people have brought up earlier in the presentation, we have 15% of our population of trees as ash versus some communities that are as high as 60%. So it's going to be an economic disaster for some communities to deal with this. I also would like to talk about what has been budgeted toward this effort and how we're already feeling the crunch in those budgets that have been allocated. So in 2018, this past year, there was $325,000 allocated, and I mentioned that we spent $266,000. So we covered our costs last year. But we're already going to fall short in 2019. We asked for $350,000. City leaders chose to diminish that amount to $275,000. And in fact, they've capped our budget for the next 3 years at $275,000 a year to manage EAB. And so I just want to share, based on known costs and known mortality, that in 2019, this year, we expect the total cost to the city to be about $350,000, the amount that we asked for. So we're going to fall short starting this year unless, you know, changes are made immediately, really. In 2020, we requested $450,000. They've allocated $275,000. And we've estimated, based on known numbers, that we are going to, that it's going to cost us, I'm sorry, I lost my track here. It's going to cost $686,000 in 2020. So we're going to be dramatically short of what we're going to need to fight the battle against EAB. So that's the impacts it's having to the city, but I'd be remiss if I didn't touch on the impacts that it's having to the citizens of our community, because I really feel that they're being hit even harder than the city. You know, the majority of trees in an urban canopy reside on private property because private property is the biggest landholder versus public land holdings. And so this has become a burden to our citizens, but it's increasingly becoming a burden to the city because we're having to finance the removals on private property because people can't afford them. And so just a couple more numbers. In 2017, the city financed $93,000 worth of removals on private property. And in 2018, they financed $80,000 on private property. Why the drop? I do believe that we've seen a trend in people handling more of the removals on their own and not letting it get to the city being involved with the removal and subsequently contracting the work and then charging it back to them. We've had to make other changes. For instance, when we identify more than 75 cumulative inches of trees on a property is infested, we're having to allow additional time because the burden for a private property owner to remove that many trees in the short amount of time, which is a time is driven by ordinance regulations, it just wasn't working. And I mentioned that we're having to finance landowners, and how we do that is if we have to intervene and remove a tree on private property, then based on the cost of removal, they will get a certain amount of time to pay for that tree when their taxes become due. So it gets assessed against the property. For instance, if the tree removal cost is $1,000 or less, they have to pay for it in that year. If the removal is $1,000 to $5,000, they'll have up to 3 years to pay for it. So they simply divide that amount by three, and a third of it is due each time their taxes are due. And when it's $5,000 and over, they are allowed a seven-year time frame to pay for it. So this is going to continue to be a bigger burden on the city in terms of financing private property removals. The bottom line is, at some point, we're going to have to stop diminishing or stop, providing the services that we typically provide. And so what are we going to give up? Planting trees, pruning trees, removing stumps? I mean, those are probably the first things that come to my mind that we'll have to give up in order to keep up with the expenses that EAB is causing. We are experiencing issues with our brush dump and landfills in Rochester. They're already at max capacity, and we're only about halfway through the removals that we have this year. And so we are doing everything that we can. We're following best management practices to slow the spread by removing not only infested trees but woodpeck trees. We are not moving wood during the summertime when the adult flight season is active. And we're trying to enlist community immunity, which is the idea that treated trees are helping to protect non-treated trees. And our management plan calls for the treatment of about 2,500 trees citywide. Now, I'm already being asked, how are you going to be able to meet the expectations with the budgets that have been laid out? And certainly one way would be to quit providing services, stop replanting the trees. Another way would be to treat more trees. As Karen pointed out, these trees are providing benefit, and those benefits actually offset the cost of treatment. And so treating trees becomes a very good way to try to not only retain canopy, retain the benefits, but also lower the costs. We're also doing everything we can in our reforest efforts to diversify. And so we're following some guiding principles of not trying to use genera that have relatively few species and trying to limit any one genera from comprising 5% of our canopy. So keeping each genera at 5% or less of our total canopy cover. So this is a real problem. Rochester's experiencing it. And I would strongly urge all of you to consider appropriating funds for a grant matching program. I really truly feel that allowing the state to manage these funds and to allocate them in a way that will help effectively manage it at a statewide level is in everyone's best interest. So thank you for hearing me.
Thank you, Mr. Haberman. I think we're going to thank you very much, and I think we're going to bring up our next three presenters in the essence of time. This has been tremendous information. Thank you. Thank you, and welcome to the committee. You may proceed.
Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jeff Travis, and I'm a program manager with the Washington County Department of Public Health and Environment. And I'm here this afternoon representing the Partnership on Waste and Energy. The partnership is a joint powers of Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington counties dealing with waste and energy management issues, including legislation and policy, communication, outreach, planning, and evaluation. So we coordinate on all of our solid waste activities. We're pleased to be here this afternoon to share our thoughts from a county perspective on managing wood waste from the emerald ash borer issue. And I'd like to quickly provide a county perspective in three areas. The waste management system, potential problems if we don't plan, and then moving forward to address EAB wood waste. So my first point about the waste management system, in Minnesota, counties are responsible for waste management planning and assuring the state goals are met, as Mr. Benke was mentioning, and this includes tree waste management. It fits into the solid waste arena. The emergence of EAB and the loss of ash trees is creating now and in the future significant amounts of wood waste, and that will need to be managed. How this material is handled and managed intersects with many of the other issues about benefits and impacts to communities. Wood waste, as was mentioned, will be coming from both public and private lands, and system approaches will probably need to be different, as Mr. Habman was mentioning in Rochester. Landscape mulch markets are nearly saturated and at this point cannot absorb the volume of wood waste that will be generated due to EAB. Wood waste can also not be buried or placed in the solid waste, and open burning is not allowed. At present, use of wood waste in biomass energy plants is one of our good ways and alternatives to manage this material. The second point I'd like to discuss is potential problems if we don't plan for this issue. Without a coordinated and planful approach, EAB wood waste will almost certainly be mismanaged. Yard waste collection sites, which are often run by cities or counties, could easily be overwhelmed with EAB material, and so we'll need to look at that capacity. If EAB material is stockpiled, there can be a risk of spontaneous combustion, as we saw with elm trees in the past, if those wood yards aren't managed properly. Residents, as Mr. Habman mentioned, may be unwilling to pay to dispose of these materials. They may stockpile it in their backyards or other properties. There may be an increase in backyard burning, which could have urban air quality impacts. Illegal dumping of ash wood is likely to increase. We believe without a planful, proactive solution, there will be calls in the end for local and state government, but we'll be in a reactive mode, and that's not where we want to be. And then my third point is about moving forward from a county waste management perspective to address this issue. As mentioned, in the 7-county metro area, there's nearly 3 million ash trees. Translated, that's nearly 10 million cubic yards of wood waste. That's just a lot of material, and that's been impressed to you in a variety of ways today. We do need a coordinated approach. We believe that includes developing innovative alternate markets, whether it's mulch or other forest products markets, especially in the urban area where the impacts are being felt right now. We believe that further development of landscape mulch markets will be part of the solution. We also believe that we need to assure the continued use of existing facilities that use wood waste for energy production, and we'll be hearing about that shortly. And also, we should be investing and looking at emerging technologies, as have been mentioned, with the University of Minnesota and other organizations. We should also continue to make efforts to control and the spread of EAB, including the quarantines and education of our communities. And finally, I also agree with other speakers that we do need to address the economics of this issue, and there needs to be a funding solution in order to get ahead of the issue. Thanks for the opportunity to present today, and if you have any questions, I'll be around here later. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Travis. Who would like to go next?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Ken Smith. I'm the President and CEO of Evergreen Energy and District Energy St. Paul, one of the solution providers that's been mentioned here today. We've been operating our cogen facility, a biomass-fired cogen facility, since 2003, located here in downtown St. Paul. The facility was developed in part to help this community deal with waste wood, the disposal of waste wood, and turn it into renewable electricity and thermal energy for the heating of buildings. It's our primary source of heating in downtown St. Paul, including the Capitol Complex, and this building is all heated with wood, as makes up 50 to 60% of our energy needs for heating. Each year, approximately 260,000 tons of wood waste is utilized to generate electricity and heat. And that renewable energy then is the electricity is sold to Xcel through the biomass mandate for a portion of it. And the thermal energy then is distributed to over 200 buildings in the downtown area. Tree waste comes from local units of government, private landowners, businesses who need help dealing with tree trimmings, brush, storm damage, invested in diseased trees that you've heard here today. Over the last 5 years, we have processed tree waste from over 115 communities in 22 counties. You should have a handout that shows a map of the counties and highlighted the counties that we take in tree waste from, and we process it into biomass fuel. Many of those communities are now facing emerald ash borer. By state law, as you've heard, this material cannot be landfilled. It has to be dealt with, and we are an outlet for that. We deal with a majority of the tree waste here in the metro area and in the counties that you've identified here on the map. As emerald ash borer has spread, we have seen a significant uptake in the amount of tree waste that we're getting that is EAB contaminated. As you've also heard, there's guidelines and rules on how this material has to be handled, when it can be transported, and so forth, and we follow all of those. In 2017 and 18, we experienced a significant increase. At times in the past year, approximately 50% of the tree waste that we've been handling has been EAB contaminated. So it's been a significant increase. In recent conversations, and you heard here today, we've learned that the estimated volume of infected tree waste to be generated from EAB in just the 7-county metro area is in excess of 1.7 million tons of tree waste. It is a significant amount of tree waste. To give you an idea what it takes to move that much tree waste in the form of wood chips, that's over 75,000 tractor trailer loads, the largest tractor trailers that you can use to transport that amount of material. And again, that is just the 7-county metro area. In our 15 years of operation, Environmental Wood Supply and St. Paul Cogen have been a primary solution for the orderly management of tree waste in the region's tree waste. And we've heard today that this is we're just the beginning of this, and it's going to have a devastating effect in communities, and already is in some of them. And that's going to become an even greater financial and logistical challenge for local governments and state to deal with emerald ash borer as it kills millions of trees. We stand ready as a company to continue to partner with communities to be that outlet for to make beneficial use of it and provide that public purpose. We are very glad to see. Thank you very much for holding this hearing. We've often thought of this as something that's kind of not really well known, how large the problem is and how much of the impact it is going to have in this community. If you want to get a sense of the scale, I don't know about that. That's not me. Oh, man. I'm so sorry. It was me. I bumped my watch. I was calling my son, who's working out in North Dakota, apparently. Sorry about that. My apologies. I would encourage you, if you want to get a sense of scale of what we're talking about, just a few miles from here, near Pig's Eye Lake, is where we handle tree waste that's coming in, and we process into biomass fuel. It is a significant operation, and we take in, you heard from Rochester, that material, a lot of that is coming right here to produce energy in St. Paul. So I encourage you, if you want to get a sense of scale, we can schedule a tour. It's just a couple of miles away, down by Holman Fields, and we can show you what it takes to manage this amount of material. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. I think I might take you up on that. I would really like to. I was not aware of that operation, so I'd really like to take that. And if anyone would like to go along, we can set up that tour and go take a look. So thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I will be very brief, kind of asked to wrap things up and I think that's easy to do because you've heard a lot of different aspects of the scope and scale and different impacts of this problem today. Minnesota cities are where the battle is at with this right now, and that's changing over time. It changes, obviously. There are places not in cities that are having significant issues right now, but it's really being focused on in the metropolitan areas and in smaller urban areas, just small community forests. But we do have, you know, the scale and the impacts it has on a city can be very, very different from community to community. You know, you're very familiar with the fight that's been going on in the Twin Cities against this because you've heard cases made for it over the time. Last year, there was $1.3 million allocated for the city of St. Paul to help them with their expenses on this. Was just talking with them as we were waiting to come up here. They expect they have $2.5 million of expenses to deal with Emerald Ash Borer this year. The scale of it is kind of mind-boggling. And now put that to a smaller community where they do not have forest staff, where they do not have expertise and a good inventory already in place. And they're trying to figure out, what do we do just with the trees on our boulevards and our parks, much less when we start having residents call and say, my tree's dying, what do I do? This is going to take a lot of work. And we're frankly behind. We haven't had a chance to get this program up and running to where I think all of us, the agency folks that were here and the community folks that have been up here, would agree that we probably need to be. But we are having success in keeping the growth slow for maybe some good luck reasons, maybe some good effort reasons. But I think we need to continue that. The impacts of this are very real on communities. If you start having all the trees in your community go down, your property value goes down with it real quick. Nobody wants to come in and buy a house where all the trees in the street are gone. The community aesthetics and just how people feel about being in the community also is affected. You'll have crabbier people at the grocery store when you go home. But it also has very real impacts on things like energy costs, because you're losing a big shade canopy that's helping you reduce heat costs, you know, cooling costs from heat in the summer. It has, as you heard, very real stormwater implications. You get a big tree canopy, and there's a reason if it's raining, you get under a tree. The water doesn't come down. It stays on those leaves. It spreads over those leaves, hangs on them, and often just evaporates back into the air after the rain stops. It's a huge part of stormwater management to have a healthy tree canopy to keep that water on the plants instead of having it run into our lakes and streams through our stormwater systems. So it really is important and very expensive to replace these trees as a system in our communities, and we really do look forward to working with the legislature to find ways you can help us do that. I think it's going to be a very important partnership that we need to have on this. So, Madam Chair, thank you very much for getting this discussion going this session. I look forward to the continued discussions of how we can do that.
Thank you, and I'd like to thank all of our testifiers for being here today. I think this was a very informative session, and I apologize to the committee for not leaving time for questions, but if you do have questions for a specific member, please get a hold of us and on the committee here, and we'll make sure those questions get answered. So thank you, members, and with that, we are adjourned.